Canada and internationally, I first heard of Stephen through a colleague of mine, Charles Ungerleiter. But we won't go down that path unless Stephen wants to. I see Don smiling. So those of us who are Canadian in the audience know about that wonderful exchange between Stephen and Charles. So I know that Stephen is going to be very, very provocative, which is exactly what we want him to do. We're very pleased that he's able to join us today. So Stephen, the floor is yours.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you for the introduction. There is no clock in here, and I understand I have something like an hour, so if somebody can like wave frantically when it's time for me to stop. I won't take it personally. I'll just wrap up my remaining 10 slides at that point.
It took about 40 minutes. Yes.
40 minutes. Well, see, that's worth knowing. You see what I mean? This is interesting for me. This is the university my father went to. It was Sir George Williams at the time, and so it's my first time speaking in this building on this campus, and it's kind of neat to think that he was actually studying in this building, and maybe even in this very room once upon a time. So it's kind of like a homecoming for me. I am originally from Montreal, and so Montreal always is and always will be home for me. Preparing for this talk, I'm not sure if I did the right thing or not, but it's what I did. I prepared for it by reading some Heidegger and walking around the city of Montreal taking photographs while thinking about the subject of identity. And the result of that is I have three separate presentations. One presentation is the photos that you've been watching so far. Those photos are me thinking about identity walking up and down St. Catherine Street. And that's enough of those for now. The second presentation is the technical presentation and the one that most resembles the actual title of this presentation on the subject of my digital identity, where I'll be talking about some of the technical aspects of representing identity online. And my third presentation, which I wrote at about 3 in the morning on hotel stationery. It's one of those hotels that they only gave me 8 sheets. So I don't have much more than that. And so this is the concept of identity. And so all of that kind of merges together. And I know it's going to be a bit of a mess, but I think it's a good mess. And so I want you to think of this presentation not as something that is finished, but rather as something that has just started, and one day down the line it will actually be done, but it's not going to be done today. But it'll be close. So my digital identity. So there's my talk, and I want to talk about, let me begin with Heidegger a little bit. Heidegger. And let me say right off the bat, I am not an authority on Heidegger. I am not going to represent myself as an authority on Heidegger in any way, shape, or form. Anything that I say off these notepads is my thinking as a result of Heidegger and is not Heidegger itself. So I don't want to be caught up in some sort of interpretive or redactive kind of criticism. These are just thoughts. These are not Heidegger. But one of the central questions that we're dealing with at this conference, and indeed with the subject of e-portfolios, is what is identity, what is the self, what is the person, what are the capacities, the competences of the person, and as a consequence, our inquiry is framed in the form of a question. And it's important to keep in mind, and we have to keep in mind throughout this presentation, and indeed throughout the entire inquiry, that any time there is a question, there are things that come with that question. One thing is the thing that we are inquiring about, whether it's a nature, a capacity, an ability, a skill. Another thing is the thing that we are asking that question of. We assume that we are asking the question of the student, for example, but in fact, when we're working with things like digital identities and digital portfolios, our inquiry is not of the student, but of a body of work, typically representative of the student. So we need to keep that in mind. And then third, there is always a presupposition when we make an inquiry of any sort about the sort of thing that we might get in response. If we ask for grades, we'll get grades back. If we ask for capacities, we'll get capacities back. So all of these things interplay in the nature of our inquiry. So let me talk a little bit about the technology itself that we're dealing with. And I borrowed some comments from one of the articles that Helen Barrett referred to yesterday and posted up on her blog, some remarks of Gary Brown. One aspect is a shift from the idea that a learner takes a course from a particular institution or a learner has a particular source or a particular authority that is teaching them or representing the state of the world to them. Rather, what is happening more and more online, 50%, which I think seems high, but we'll leave that aside, are studying from multiple sources, multiple institutions, often at the same time. So the very idea that any system like a learning management system or an e-portfolio system, etc., is something that is created and managed by the institution is in a way seriously misguided. If people are taking things from multiple institutions, then if we have an application that is a single point of reference of their learning, that application must be multi-institutional. Gary Brown also talked about the idea of the e-portfolio becoming or adapting to Web 2.0, and the idea here is that the e-portfolio resembles less and less a content management system, less and less a single place, a single location where a student puts all of their work, and becomes more and more what is being referred to as a personal learning environment. Personal learning environment adopts and embraces Web 2.0 methodologies, and in particular, three things. Web 2.0, which is AJAX and REST-based technology, and those are just fancy technical terms, which mean really nothing more that they are technologies that can, or they are applications that can make inquiries of other applications. And the three domains of inquiry come into play here. We need to know what we're asking about, we need to know what we're asking to, we need to know what we expect to get in return. When we define things like asynchronous JavaScript and XML, when we define representational state transfer, what we're trying to do is understand the kinds of questions one application can ask of another application. It involves distributed content, that is to say, content that is located not in one place on the World Wide Web, not in one place on the Internet, but rather in multiple locations. Kind of like this presentation. If you think about even your own web presence now, you have a Facebook account, you have a Flickr, well, you may have a Facebook account, a Flickr account, a YouTube account where you've uploaded your videos and your friends' videos and stuff from TV. You have, your website, your blog, all of the rest of these things. They're all spread out across the Internet. And the whole idea of a distributed profile is getting a picture of all of those things that are spread out all over the Internet and thinking of them as one thing. And each one of these things, Google Docs, Facebook, etc., they all have collaborative, they all have community-based, they all have communicative elements to them. So these representations of the self that are out there in the world are not simply static artifacts. They are actually conversations that you have with the rest of the world. Here's the world-famous personal learning environment diagram. It was actually created before anybody came up with the term personal learning environment. So it says future VLE in there instead. It's authored by Scott Wilson. There have been numerous variations of this diagram since. But you get the idea of the distributive nature, 43 things for your task list, Flickr for your photos, LiveJournal for your blog posts, etc. And what makes the PLE, is the way that the communication takes place from entity to entity to entity. That's the kind of technology, the kind of technological environment that we're looking at. Now let me think a bit about identity. 40 minutes, eh? Identity is funny. Identity, it used to be an ontological problem. It used to be a question about being, right? You wanted to establish an identity. You produce a body. That's identity. One person, one body. It was perfect. On the internet, we don't have that anymore. On the internet, we have a situation where we have identities without bodies. And you might kind of think, well, that doesn't even make sense. But think about, I don't want to do that one, I want to do this one. I'm changing the order of these. That's the original order. Think about identity the way, think about identity the way we think about it in everyday, ordinary life. This is switching from presentation number one to presentation number two. So, we're born, we live, we die in time. And we have a certain presence in space. I think Heidegger should have called it being or space and time, but we'll leave that aside. So, space, we take up space. Some of us take up more space than others. But our identity does not begin and end there. This is the corpus, this is the body. But our identity has much more than just that. Heidegger has a lot to talk about the way the past plays a role in our identity. And that's a major theme in a lot of the photographs that you saw, the way the past shapes who we are, how the past becomes what we are. I was thinking as I was walking up and down St. Catharines and looking at all the Montreal Canadiens signs, I'm really sorry about that, how you can have a person with two identical properties. He scored 32 goals, say. For one player, that's a great achievement. It's the peak of his career. For another player, it's his career is in decline. He's going to retire now. Right? The present is informed by the past. And there's also the future. What could be. And similarly, we have extra body dimensions in space as well. We have what we might call the inner, for lack of a better word. And we have the outer, which is the rest of the world. And what happens when we're establishing identity, particularly when we're talking about identity on the internet, is we're talking about projections of the self from here to these four dimensions. We have, and there's an interesting division here, between, on the one hand, action, the things that we do in the world, and on the other hand, reflection, the things that we think about the world. And now the reason why I think this is relevant is because the question of identity, the question of understanding what this person isn't simply a point-by-point picking out of this sort of thing. Like, talking about Charles Unger later. Here's a test. Here's a competence. And we have a line, right? And that's an inference, isn't it? An inference from a test to a potential for some action. But the problem is that represents in only one dimension something that is very complex. And that is the beginning and the end of my difficulty with testing, is that it is a very limited, very simple point of view. When we're talking about identity, we're talking about all of this, but when we're talking about measuring identity, typically we're talking about one dimension of that. So much for that. So, technologies of identity. The quest. Hi, welcome, and to wrap up my talk today. No. Identity has kind of changed. If you go back to the world of Descartes and things like that, it was, you know, a question like, who am I? What is my nature? What is my essential nature? These days, questions of identity become, maybe it has to do with our bar culture and IDing yourself, is okay, how you can prove who you are to someone else. And notice the way the question has changed, right? Notice the way the asker of the question has changed. Notice the way the whatever it is to which the question is being put has changed. And the problem is, it used to be, to identify yourself, it was very simple. You just step forward and the guard at the gate would recognize you. Real simple. Now, there's no such way of doing that. There's no way to do that anymore. Let me draw out two very different concepts, and very importantly different. First of all, identification, sometimes known as self-identification. This is my assertion that I am a certain person. As compared with authentication, this is the verification, presumably by a third party, that I am who I say I am. You see the difference, right? Identification is really a kind of self-verification. Who am I? And I love this line, right? It's central to our being, isn't it? When a person becomes amnesiac, when they lose their memory, their first question is, who am I? As opposed to, what is the capital of France? That's what they want to know. And importantly, my sense of self, my sense of identity depends crucially on my remembering who I am, and in a certain way, remembering what my attributes are. You cannot have identity in time without identity in history. Now, I have different ways of describing who I am, and each different way I describe who I am corresponds to a different way of thinking about myself. I have a name, Stephen Downs, but it turns out my name is not sufficient to identify me. Stephen Downs is also the name of a restaurant critic in Melbourne, Australia. Is also the name of an NDP candidate in Nova Scotia. Is also the name of a cognitive psychologist who works at Utah. Who's also the name of a football player in England. I've learned all this searching for myself on the internet. In identity, there is a presumption of uniqueness. And in order to establish uniqueness, you need multiple naming systems. Some of them are more or less permanent, like in Canada, social insurance number. Others of which are transient and less permanent, school number. Well, actually, that is, what is it? 8821721. That's my student number from University of Calgary. I think I got that wrong, though. Phone numbers, PINs, etc. Problem is, there's too many numbers. Nobody can remember them all. So we carry tokens with us. Here are my tokens, right? And credit card, and etc. Right? And that way, I don't need to remember all of these numbers. I just refer to the token, and that's what tells me what. And it's kind of funny, right? My tokens tell me who I am. If I didn't have my tokens, if I didn't have things that are external to me, I wouldn't know who I am because I wouldn't be able to name myself. And there are various encodings of these tokens. Now, that's identification. What about authentication? How do I prove to someone else that I am who I say I am? Well, first of all, I have to know who I am. There is no authentication without there first being identification. There is no way I can prove to you that I am who I say I am unless I can say to myself, I am who I am. So let's think about the two major cases of identity claims that are made in context of authentication. First of all, I am P when I am P. In other words, an accurate or correct identity claim. And if that's the case, everything's fine, we don't need to worry. The problematic case is when I say I am P, when in fact I am not P, I am someone else. Now, how do I prove that I am or am not P? Well, if I can't present the body, because typically I present the body, but if I can't present the body, I'm going to present a token. And if it's online, I'm going to present a digital token. Something like, say, a password or a PIN number or something like that. But what's really important to understand is that There is nothing inherently in the token that establishes the authenticity of my identity claim. A pin is just a pin. Only when a pin is seen or viewed in a certain context is that an identity claim. There's nothing in the pin itself. Think about the example of the bank machine, right? I give my card, which is the physical token, and my PIN number, which is a digital token, to my wife, and I say, go get me $100. She goes to the bank, presents the card, presents the ID number, gets $100. There's nothing in the presentation of the card and the ID number that establishes that that person is who they claim to be. So, there's nothing in the claim itself that prevents it from being a false claim. This is very important. Because what it means is, in the end, no system of authentication succeeds, ever. And this is the conclusion of the famous Microsoft DarkNet paper. Now, what do I mean by succeeds? Well, what I mean is, by establishing to a sufficient degree of certainty that my claim to be P is in fact true. Now, this standard will vary, but we can take very stringent standards or very loose standards. The result ends up the same. Think about how we authenticate. Typically, we rely on the testimony of a third party. Look at my tokens again. Here are my tokens. This is authenticated by Case Populaire. This is authenticated by the government of New Brunswick. This is authenticated by Costco. But you have more or less reliable authorities. Right? But now, the question is, how do they know I am who I am? Well, typically, I went to them and said, I am so-and-so. And what did they do? They took my word. See, when you have a case of testimony from a third party, you basically created the same problem, but another iteration down, particularly in an online environment, where now instead of proving I am who I am to the one place, I'm proving I am who I am to another place, and then using that proof to establish my proof here. But there's all kinds of ways of misrepresenting myself. And even then, even if I have proved to the satisfaction of someone else that I am who I am, if I give my cards to somebody or if somebody steals my cards and my PIN numbers, they can still claim to be me, even if they are not me. The problem is essentially there is no token that is nobly unique to me that I can't share other than my own body, which I can't share by definition. There is no token that I can present that establishes that I am me beyond the shadow of a doubt. It just does not exist.
What about pieces of yourself? Biometric data or...
Right. Okay. There are many ways... that's a good question. What about pieces of yourself? What about biometrics? I think that's a type of proxy. Okay, there are different kinds of proxies. There are proxies that are of the self, like biometrics, and then there are external proxies, like your computer, your telephone, like your mobile phone, the chip in your computer. The thing is, these proxies can still all in some way be shared. I mean, it's the theme of who knows how many of those gruesome movies where identity is by fingerprints, so they cut off the guy's hand. Or there's many ways to spoof fingerprints. Identity is by retina, so I saw one that they gouge up the guy's eye. The thing is, biometrics depends on some kind of signature. The signature is presumed to be unique to the body that carries that signature, but since it's a signature, since it's a type of sign and not the actual entire body itself, it can always be spoofed. Especially if I, the person, and this is the key point, if I, the person burying the body and therefore the biometric, want to spoof the person. Think about biometrics, right? The other thing about false claims, where somebody else is claiming to be me. But what if I am me, but I want somebody else to be me, right? Well, there's all kinds of, there's a real simple thing, right? So suppose that door opens by a thumbprint. So, okay, no problem. Here I am. I'll unlock the door, and then I'll send you through it. I've defeated the biometrics. Because I, the owner of the token, namely my thumb, used it to deceive. And you might think, well, that would never come up, but that's exactly what comes up in examinations and testing. When it's in my interest to have someone who is not me write the test, because they will get the right answers, where I would get the wrong answers. Identity authentication depends on motivation. It depends on me not wanting somebody else to be able to self-identify as me. That's why bank cards work. Bank cards work not because they're super-duper security. They're a password system, right? No more secure in a certain sense than a website. But what bank cards have going for them is my desire not to have the entire world able to withdraw funds from my bank account, right? Similarly, even biometrics, as I say, depend on there being a cost. Even biometrics depend on me not wanting somebody else to be able to successfully pose as me. In fact, when we talk about trust, our idea of trust is exactly backwards from the way it should be. We talk about trust from the perspective of, can the resource provider trust me? But what we should be talking about is, can I trust the resource provider? Can this system that I've set up establish to my own satisfaction that I, and only I, can establish that I am who I am? I'm very conscious of the time. How am I doing on time?
Another 10 minutes.
And then about another 40 minutes. Like I said, this is the beginning, isn't it? Rather than a completed question. And indeed, the question of trust is really brought forward in very sharp relief on the internet of today, when governments share our data, companies share our data, other people share our data, when these agencies impersonate entities that we can trust in order to steal our identities and use them for their own purposes. That, rather than proving who you are, is the barrier between identity creation on the web today. So what we need to do, what we need to be sure of, is to be able to establish a system whereby a person owns their own identity, where the projections that this person makes out into the world are verifiably, to the satisfaction of the person, not an external agency, reliably the property of that person. Or in pragmatic technical terms, if a blog post out there on my account has my name on it, it had better be something that I wrote and not something that has been put there in place of something that I wrote. And we see that all the time, people attempting to steal blog accounts and then they insert horrible, vile spam, right? And this is exactly an instance of that sort of trust that we need to be able to establish. Me being able to establish that my content and not spam content will go on my blog. So identity, in the end, needs to be understood from the perspective of objectives. Needs to be understood from the perspective of potentials, of actions that we want to take. Needs to be understood from the perspective of, as Terry Anderson says, how I manage my own presence, how I manage who I am out there on the internet. I didn't like the way that came out, but just sort of see from the slide. The way this is being done in practice on the internet is through a system called OpenID. How many of you are familiar with OpenID? Five, six people. OpenID and systems like it, OpenID is the most popular, although there are other similar systems, is a system where a person's identity is essentially a website. And it's actually a fairly simple system. And you'd be surprised that it works, but it does work, and it's gaining some traction. And the idea here is as follows. A person is a website, which means that in order to claim, if you will, an open ID, you create or obtain from some provider a website. So here's a website. So I'll just call this my open ID website. And this website will have some unique URL. This URL, in my case, is downs.ca, but it could be anything. That's who I am. Now, how do I know that that's my website? Well, fairly simply, I can put something on it. This is how Technorati used to, and still does, I think, verify ownership of weblogs. Technorati, somebody signs up for Technorati, and then Technorati says, claim your blog. How does it do that? Well, Technorati gives you a unique token. You go to your blog, you log in, you put that token on your blog, and then you go back to Technorati and you say, hey, take a look. There it is. And Technorati says, oh, good. You, and only you, would have put that there. Therefore, you are the person who owns that blog. OpenID works in the same way. So, I go to some website, say Yahoo. And Yahoo wants me to log in because they're Yahoo. I want everyone to log in. So I go to Yahoo, and they ask me to log in. But instead of a name and a password, I give them a URL. And the URL redirects me here. And I log in. But also, Yahoo sends me a special token. And when I log in here, I put that token on my website. In such a way that somebody coming along who was looking for it could find it. And then my website sends me right back where I came from. Now I'm back at Yahoo. And I'm telling Yahoo, okay, I've been there. So Yahoo says, oh yeah? Well, let me check. And behind the scenes, it does one of those Ajax resty kind of inquiries. And it says, is that token there? And if it is, they go, oh, great, it's there. And so it comes back, yes, you are who you say you are. And then you can continue, you are logged in with the ID associated with that URL. That's OpenID. That's all OpenID is. What it is, though, essentially is it's not a system of authentication. You are not proving to Yahoo that you are Stephen Downs or that you are whoever you say you are. You are proving to Yahoo only that you control this website. So there's no presumption of uniqueness. There's no presumption of a physical body. The only thing that there is a presumption of is that you control this site. It's self-identification. Well, you might ask, well, what's my motivation to make this work? Well, you use this URL here, but you also, and pretend there's four lines there, do the same thing with Microsoft. And you also do the same thing with Google, etc. And the neat thing about OpenID is this is not some trusted authority. This is not some identity provider or registry system. There is no registry system at all. This is you. This is your projection of your digital identity on the web. And your motivation is this content and this content and this content. The content on these sites, you maintain control and ownership of them. And that's your distributed identity system. I probably have about 3 minutes left, 5 minutes. Ooh, more time than I thought. I want to talk very briefly about profiles. Because I'm going to take some of these concepts and some of this concept and go back to the way we talk about the sorts of things that we're talking about that are on our websites. I'm going to skip through a few slides here, but we'll just ignore that. The idea here is that we are attempting to describe resources. So here is a resource. It is out here in the world somewhere. And the question is, how do we describe this resource? And we need to be able to describe this resource in the case of e-portfolios, in the case of a personal learning environment, because this is the expression of one's external self, the token that they are going to use in order to show that they have a competence or whatever, whatever. But the thing is, the way we typically think of describing these resources is through metadata. And the presumption here is that this metadata will be an accurate or true description of this resource. The big problem is metadata lies. People lie in their metadata. If you look at learning object metadata, you see a perfect example of it. One of the fields in learning object metadata is the resource interactive? And it turns out they all are. Even flat, plain text web pages, they're all interactive. Everything in the world is interactive, according to metadata. You see, the thing is, and I wish I had more time, but oh well. Nah, I'm not going to be able to do that. Pardon? Yeah, I'm not going to eat into your time because I hate it when people do that to me. So I have no intention of doing it.
You just skipped the coffee break.
The thing is, we have multiple descriptions of any resource, and importantly, we have conflicting descriptions of any resource. So I want to think of an environment in which we describe resources in which that is the case. That should be a good shot. And that one should be in focus because I wasn't moving. Okay. Forget. This is just a complete aside. Forget about the handle system, DOIs, etc., etc. They won't work. Never mind. Moving on. What we want to think about now are the different types of metadata that attach to different types of resources. For any given resource, and that includes a person, there will be different types of metadata, bibliographical, technical, classification, etc. I don't have time to go into detail on this, but different kinds of resources have different kinds of metadata associated with them. Think, for example, of a photograph versus a video. A video has a runtime in seconds, 43 seconds, say. A photo does not. It doesn't even make sense to think of a photograph as having certain type, certain runtime. So different metadata attaches to different types of objects. What we think we know about that type of object is expressed by the metadata that we apply to it. Essentially, in this sort of world, there are three kinds of metadata. First-person metadata that is created by the author of a resource, in this case, me, and first-party metadata would be bibliographical metadata. I am the author. I created this resource on January 22nd. I was in Montreal when I did it, etc. And it might also be rights metadata. For example, I own this object. Second-party metadata is metadata created by the user of this resource, the person out here who ultimately consumes this. It might be, for example, evaluative metadata. I saw that photo, it's tanked. It's interesting, right? You'll never get that as first-party metadata. You won't get self-assessments of photos that they stink. But, well, you might, but typically not so much, especially in a commercial domain. But second-party metadata is, in a certain sense, more accurate. In a certain sense, not more accurate, because people lie about other people's stuff, too. But the point here is second-party metadata is usage metadata. I used this now. It was good. I used it in the context of a physics class, etc. And then third-party metadata is metadata created by somebody who neither produced nor used the resource. Third-party metadata, this is a resource about physics, says the Bibliographical Association of America. This is a resource that is appropriate for our students, says the Latter-day Saints Association of America. See what I mean? All these different sorts of classifications, ratings, etc., are third-party metadata. And what happens is, as these different types of metadata get produced by different people, you get what we call a profile of that metadata. Exactly the same thing happens for people. If you think about it, think about the life cycle of a resource or the life cycle of a person. It comes down to the same thing. You are born. I was born in Montreal. When I came into this world, when I was born in Montreal, I had very little metadata. I had almost none, in fact. I had a birth date. I had a location of birth. A little while later, I began to accumulate more metadata. I got named. That didn't happen until after. Exactly. It took a few days. And then they went with the German theme. We don't know why. And then as time goes by, I acquire more metadata. I went to kindergarten. I got 9 E's. E was excellent, and I was so proud. I have my first brush with the law, and there's a notation. And then I joined Boy Scouts, and I have metadata to Boy Scouts. Hey, think about where the metadata of the person is. Well, some of the metadata is with the school. Some of the metadata is with the police service. Some of the metadata is with the university. It's distributed all over the place. Right? And this is going to be true now with my metadata and my resources, and the metadata about my resources is also going to be all over the place. I create a brilliant picture that is used in physics classes around the world. Now I have information about my picture in physics departments around the world. So the idea of generating a resource profile is pulling this metadata together and then presenting a certain view or a certain perspective on that metadata, because you don't always want to know everything about a resource. Again, think of a person. If you're going on a date, you want to know one type of information about a person. How tall are they? What's their hair color? What color are their eyes? Are they a good conversationalist? If you're looking to hire somebody, you're looking at a completely different set of criteria. The same thing is going to be true of a person online. The same thing is going to be true of a resource produced by a person online. And what you're trying to do is create various perspectives, various windows on the person or on the resource that is produced by the person. Quick aside, federations don't work. Okay, I'm going to end it here, but I do want to see, and I did make it through all of my slides. But I'm to the point where I wasn't sure what I wanted to conclude from this. And as you can see, it's a horrible mess. And the first thing to conclude from this is, people who represent this stuff as simple, straightforward, you test somebody, you know what their competence is, they are lying. Secondly, profiles, like identity, must, for logical reasons, belong to the user. Because profiles are accurate only if they are produced, like passwords, with appropriate motivation. And if that motivation is not there, then the resulting profile is not reliable. And third, there cannot be, is not, and cannot be a single view, a single ultimate story on any given person, because the person is not just the thing that you see in front of you. The person is the combination of their past and their future hopes. It's the combination of their inner life and their connections and extensions to the external world. And all of these things cannot be brought together, cannot be resolved into a single view. And that is my talk, and I thank you very much for your patience. And this stuff will be on my website. I'll actually photograph all of those, because I didn't present most of the Heidegger part of the talk, which is probably appropriate. But I will put it all together in a melange of tech, Heidegger, and photographs. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Oh, and there'll be an audio recording, too.
Yes.